This afternoon's Sutta class on the Kinti Sutta. Literally the
what?
Sutta?
I don't know what it means.
Yeah.
Last week, you didn't ask me this
question. Yeah. Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Exactly. So this is the what Sutta? As usual, we'll be looking at Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation on the screen, although as Google has yet to perfect the Dana Paramita, we've only got part of it. All of it, actually not Google, it's wisdom, I guess. That's the choice about what actually is art and what isn't. So this particular sutta, look at that. Kinti. Nothing here. No little green button. Means it hasn't got any cognate suttas or corresponding suttas anything anywhere. Which is kind of weird, isn't it? Yeah? Not many suttas like that in the Majjhima. You see, almost all of them have cognate suttas. Only very, very few don't. And of those very, very few, at least one of them, for example, Anupada Sutta, we'll be looking at a bit later, is quite obviously quite a late sutta. Whether the Kinti Sutta is a late sutta, or whether it's a mere chance that it survived in the Pali and not in others, makes you wonder whether there are other suttas which might have, you know, survived or not survived. So particular one is quite a simple sutta in many ways, but has some very interesting points, and I'll just have the Pali up here for now until we get to where we have a decent English translation available on the screen. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living in Kusinara at the Grove of Offerings. So this is Pisinara. We've gone from Ku to Pi. That's interesting, isn't it? At the Bali Harane, the Bali being the offering to the ghosts and departed spirits and so on. So that's already a little bit curious. I've never heard of any other suttas in that particular location. I can't remember off the top of my head. He addressed the bhikkhus, and the bhikkhus said, and he said to the bhikkhus, Kinti! What? Bhikkhus. Okay? What do you think about me? Okay. What do you think about me? That the recluse Gotama teaches the Dhamma for the sake of roads? Jivara hetu. Okay, jivara, the robe, hetu, cause, or because. So this is an idiom. A hetu is a cause. And so because of robes, jivara hetu. That the Samana Gotama teaches the Dhamma. It's already a little bit odd, frankly. There's a few odd things come up already. Location's a little bit odd. This is a bit odd that he should refer to himself as Samana Gotama when he's speaking to the monks. It's a bit odd, isn't it? Yeah? Normally he'd use Samana Gotama if they're a non-Buddhist, like a Brahmin or something like that, might use Samana Gotama when they're talking to him. But I don't know any. Normally he'd refer to himself as the Tathagata when he's speaking to the bhikkhus. Anyway. Maybe he's repeating a rumor heard third person. There's been something going around, quite likely, yeah. Or that the recluse Gotama teaches the Dhamma for the sake of alms food, indapata hetu. Or that the recluse Gotama teaches the Dhamma for the sake of a resting place, senasana, for getting a good kuti, that's why you teach the Dhamma. Or you teach the Dhamma for the sake of some better state of being. Iti bhava bhava hetu. And Bhikkhu Bodhi has a footnote here. It's giving the commentary according to the commentarial explanation. Do you think he teaches the Dhamma as a means of gaining merit, so that he can experience happiness in this or that state of being, state of being. So this word iti bhava bhava hetu is one which iti bhava bhava is one which comes up a few times. Bhava is a state of being, right? So bhava is a state of rebirth, as independent origination and other places. Bhava bhava, this is a kind of idiomatic construction in Pali, where this is actually iti means thus or such, right? So such and such a bhava bhava. Normally when two words are compounded in Pali, this is just a bit of a digression here for all the Pali geeks among you, Blake, and normally in Pali when you have a compound, the compounded words are there's no declension at the joint of the compound, so it would be bhava bhava, right? No, so that's normally how you'd expect a compound if you wanted to compound bhava with itself. And normally if you had a long A there, then you'd expect that to mean bhava plus abhava. Okay? So normally bhava plus abhava would be bhava bhava. So a positive and a negative compounded together, which of course would make sense if for the sake of existence and non-existence or something like that, right? But that's not what this means. This is actually a ablative kind of construction. So this is actually grammatically should be broken up like that: bhava bhava. So from existence to existence, something like that. So you have similar kind of construction with things like gama gamang, like going from town to town, gama gamang. So bhava bhavang means some kind of existence or other, okay, or going from one kind of existence to another, or being in one kind of existence or another. In other words, as the idiomatic translation is, of some kind of better one, a better state of being or another that he teaches Dhamma. Okay, so we do not think that thus. No ko na ko no bhante. Na meaning translated as the English na. Okay, na. No, no doesn't mean the English no, but sometimes it does. But here, no means we. Right? So no can either be a negative or it can be we. So we do not nakko no bhagavati, regarding the Blessed One. We don't think these things. So if you don't think that you teach the Dhamma for those kinds of things, then what do you think about me? Then If as it seems, gira, then what do you think about me? Then he says, this is what we think. Anugambako bhagava hitesi. He's compassionate, okay, and seeks our welfare. He teaches the Dhamma out of compassion. Anugambang upadaya dhammang deseti. So bhikkhus, and then the Buddha goes on. So, because those dhammas that I have taught from my own direct knowledge, that is to say, now this is a very important statement and leading up to one of the most important summaries of the Buddha's whole teaching. These are those things which I have taught from my own direct knowledge. The four satipatthanas, the four right efforts, the four iddhipadas, basis of psychic power. For the five spiritual faculties, the five spiritual powers, the seven factors of awakening, the Noble Eightfold Path. So that's that list. Now that's, of course, the basic list of dhammas, which we today call the Bodhipakkhya dhammas. The wings to awakening, literally. Now, that particular group is never called the Bodhipakkhya Dhammas as such in the canon, but that's the kind of conventional term it became known as afterwards. And it's something which obviously is fundamental to the Buddha's own conception, or what he believed his fundamental teaching to be. So, you know, he wasn't summarizing his teaching as being, oh, I've taught you all of these Jataka stories, or I've taught you these inspiring verses, or I've taught you these good jokes, or whatever. These are the things that he really emphasized and said, these are the things that you should remember as being the essence of my teaching. And he came back to this again and again and again. That's true. There's some very important topics, but and the other ones obviously is the five khandhas, the six sense bases, dependent origination, and the elements. So there are some very important Dhamma topics that are not mentioned here, and of course that's been one of the major things that I discussed, especially in the first part of History of Mindfulness. Like, there was a relationship between these, and in fact, if you take this group and if you take the five aggregates, the senses, the elements, dependent origination, and the Four Noble Truths, more or less, then that list of Dhammas is what is the basic list of topics for the Samyutta Nikaya. So I call this the Samyutta Matika, and also was the foundation list of topics for the main Abhidhamma texts of the different schools, and is also the fundamental list of topics for the several of the important Mahayana sutras, like the Heart Sutra and others, and remained important in later Buddhism. So this list is the Fourth Noble Truth, exactly. So you see what when you say this doesn't have the Noble Truths in it, see, the Noble Truths in a sense don't fit in that list because they encompass the whole thing. So this is the first truth. Oops, this is the Ist Truth. A very important Ist one is the aggregate senses and elements. Dependent origination is the second and third. Okay, the cause of suffering and the cessation of suffering is dependent origination. And then the fourth noble truth is the path. So in that list of topics, the noble truths in a sense are not a sort of a separate list which sits next to on the same level as that, but it's another sort of plane up. These are all more detailed descriptions of aspects of the Four Noble Truths. Okay, and as you mentioned, other topics, things like the three marks of existence, anicca, dukkha, anatta, and so on, are all again more refined parts of these. In the course, anicca, dukkha, anatta coming up, especially under the First Noble Truth, very often. Okay, so tatta sabheva samage samodamani hiyavyadamani hisikita bang. Now that phrase, you should train in these things with in harmony and mutual rejoicing without disputing, each and every one of you. This is exactly the same phrase which is recited at the end of the Bhikkhu Parimokkha. Okay, so when we recite our list of rules at every fortnight. And tata sabbeheva samaghehi samodamanehi avivadamanehi sikhita bandhi. So this is exactly the same phrase. And elsewhere, so here it's saying that you should train in these things, so you should do them. In other places, there's very similar passages where it doesn't just say that you should train them, but also says that you should recite them. And this is found in some of the Sanskrit parallels to this particular passage. So in other words, this is given as a framework for both practice and also for teaching. It's the basic list of dhammas. So there's obviously something that's very important, and this kind of teaching was something that was quite characteristic of the last days of the Buddha's life. It's similar things are taught several times in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, as well as in suttas around, say, the death of Mahavira, the leader of the Jains, and so on. And this is why it's interesting, why it's at Pisinara, or perhaps Kusinara. One wonders whether it's an episode given in the last days of the Buddha's life, which somehow isn't in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, but that's just speculative. Now the other interesting little point about this one is the next section, where while you are reciting these, or while you are training in these things in harmony, with mutual rejoicing and without disputing, it is possible, siyangsu, dwe bhikkhu, that two bhikkhus, abhidhamme nanavada. So, okay, so it's possible that some bhikkhus might have different ideas about the Abhidhamma. Okay? Nana vada. Nana is various or many. Okay? And vada means speech. So, nana vada doesn't mean that they say to each other, na 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 na. Okay? That's not what it means. Okay? Although that might happen too. But nana means various. It's the same as in nana chat, yeah? What monastery, what nana chat? Nana chat is the literally birth, but means nation in Thai, or nationality. Nana chat is many nationalities, international, yeah? So nana, many doctrines about the Abhidhamma. Right? Now, so this is quite interesting, because we know from historical studies, of course, that the Abhidhamma wasn't around in the time of the Buddha, wasn't composed until a few centuries later. So what are these two bhikkhus arguing about? This could either be seen as a sign of that the sutta is a later interpolation, or it could be seen as an early use of the word Abhidhamma, which might give a clue to how the first Abhidhamma was conceived within the Buddhist community. In fact, I think the answer is the latter, because the word Abhidhamma here is not actually associated with any specifically Abhidhamic ideas. Right? If we were to find the use of the word Abhidhamma, and in connection with that, some ideas that are characteristic of the Abhidhamma, then we could associate those two things. But we don't. We just find straight teachings associated with the early suttas. So what this is likely, the use of the word Abhidhamma here, is an early... typical of an early usage of the word, which would have been the one of the kind of the basis, or this is like the natural language usage of the word, which later evolved into the technical meaning of Abhidhamma as a particular kind of literature, class of literature. And now, of course, what it's referring to, of course, it's referring back to these teachings, isn't it? Yeah. So it's referring back to the four Satipatthanas, four right efforts, four Iddhipadas, five spiritual faculties, five spiritual powers, seven awakening factors, and Noble Eightfold Path. So it suggests that the earliest or a early conception of what we know of Abhidhamma was these teachings. And in fact, when we looked in the existing Abhidhamma, we find that these teachings form the framework of one important part of the early Abhidhamma is the book called the Vibhanga, which has a set of chapters which deals with exactly these topics, including the aggregates and so on, but also these topics relating to the path. And so it seems very likely that this is what the earliest meaning of Abhidhamma is. And so to notice that when it's put this way, so when the Buddha makes this list, he says, you know, you should practice in these things, the four Satipatthanas and the four right efforts and so on and so forth. It sounds like he's just talking about the things themselves, right? You practice the four Satipatthanas and so on and so forth. But it must have a more developed sense than that, okay? It must have a sense of an actual body of teachings, okay? Because that's the kind of thing that you can dispute about, right? If the Buddha is just saying, oh, you should have your right efforts, yeah, then no one's really going to argue about that. But when you have a body of teachings, then this is where the disputes start. And similarly, this is why in other cases where it says that you should recite these things, and obviously it's referring to a particular collection of texts. It doesn't just mean you just sit there and go four Satipatthanas, four right efforts, four Iddhipadas and so on. It's the same thing, you recite these things. It means you recite a group of teachings which are on these texts. So this is one of the reasons why I made the argument in History of Mindfulness that these teachings were, which today are collected primarily in the Samyutta Nikaya, constituted the earliest canon of Buddhist scripture. Okay, and so if we want to find out what the path was and what the teachings were in the earliest sense, then the chief topics, these topics in the Samyutta Nikaya, is the place where we should be starting our search. So now we have some from here.
Does that infer then that there was probably lots and lots of other teachings that
people lost? Why would you infer that?
Because you're talking not just about these things, you know, you said that when they're talking about the higher dhammas, and if there's something for disputation, it means that there must be, body of teaching,
yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah.
And are you saying that is something that's something like the Samyutta Nikaya?
Right. Yeah, like the proto-Samyutta, the original collection, which sort of evolved and developed into what we have today as the Samyutta Nikaya. Personally, I personally don't think that there's likely to be many things lost from the early scriptures. I think that the first thing is that there was obviously such a massive and very skillful effort to preserve them. Yeah. So of course things can be lost, but. But there was such an effort, and that what's been preserved is of such a good quality that I find it difficult to believe that major things could be lost. That's one reason. Second reason is because if you take this seriously, which this is the theory that I developed in the history of mindfulness, especially the first part of it called the gist, then what that says is that this list of teachings is not arbitrary. Right? That it actually has a structure, and that structure relates to the Four Noble Truths. Right? So once you know the architectural plan, well, you know if there's a wall missing. Yeah. So yes, I mean there could be a couple of bad bricks in the wall, right? That's always possible. But there's not possible that there could be a wall missing, you know, a major part missing from the structure without actually knowing it, because we know what the overall architecture of it's supposed to look like. So, and that, of course, then that's confirmed by the comparative study across the different collections. You know, there are small things. Just for example, the seven bojangas, or seven awakening factors. Now, one of those awakening factors is the samadhi bojanga, the awakening factor of samadhi. Now, everywhere else in these things where samadhi is defined, it's always defined as the four jhanas. And we'd expect that the samadhi bojanga would also be defined as the four jhanas, right? But there's nowhere in Pali Samyutta that actually says that. What it says is that there's samadhi with vitakkam vichara and without vitakkam vichara. Okay. Now, obviously, again, that's referring to the four jhanas, right? But it doesn't actually say so in as many words in the Pali. But in the Chinese equivalent collection, it does actually say that. So it does make that identification. So there are little things like that where there may be, you know, little pieces of the puzzle which are not so clear. But I think, generally speaking, that it's preserved pretty well. Okay, all right. So, if you should think thus, I come back to the English. If you should think thus, those venerable ones differ about both the meaning and the phrasing. Okay, so this is this distinction being brought in: the meaning, attato, or the atta. Okay, the meaning of the text, and the byanjana. Okay, the to here is just an ablative ending meaning about the. So, but the actual word itself is atta, about the meaning, the atta, the point of it, and the byanjana, the expression. Okay, byanjana also being a word for source, dressing. They differ about both the meaning and the phrasing. Then whichever because you think is the more reasonable should be approached and addressed that. So first of all, notice how again this comes back to these questions of epistemology, which we find so often again and again and again. How do you know, right? What's the actual means by which you learn about these things? Yeah, and the Buddha always gave a very common sense epistemology. He doesn't say go to the one who's enlightened, right? Because if you're enlightened yourself, well, then you know the answer and it's not a problem. If you're not enlightened, how do you know who's enlightened or whatever, right? It doesn't say go to the most senior one. It doesn't say go to the most famous one. It doesn't say go to the one who tells the best jokes in his Dhamma talks, right? But to the one who you think is the more reasonable, Okay, it's very common sense, and we're giving the responsibility back on the person. Actually, use your judgment. You judge for yourself. Who do you think is the most reasonable? And address us. The Venerable Ones differ about both the meaning and the phrasing. The Venerable Ones should know that it is for this reason that there is difference about the meaning and difference about the phrasing. Let them not fall into a dispute. Okay? So, to try to explain where the dispute is coming from. Then whichever bhikkhu you think is most reasonable, who's on the opposite part, should be approached and addressed thus. The Venerable Ones differ about the meaning and phrasing. The Venerable should know that it is for this reason that there is difference about the meaning and difference about the phrasing. Let them not fall into a dispute. So what has been wrongly grasped should be borne in mind as wrongly grasped. Bearing in mind what has been wrongly grasped as wrongly grasped, what is Dhamma and what is Vinaya should be expounded. So, very common sense approach to that. What's wrongly grasped, the very literal translation, duggahitam, literally meaning badly grasped. Having a meaning of also learnt or remembered. Okay, so here we have duggahitam, what has been badly grasped, should be dharetabam, should be remembered. What is well grasped should be remembered as well grasped. Okay, so I talked a little bit last week in the Dhamma talk about mindfulness, the word sati, and about how in the sense of memory it's equivalent to the word dharana. And so here we have the word dharana appearing in its normal meaning of to remember or to bear in mind. Okay, so what's badly grasped should be borne in mind, should be remembered as badly grasped, and so on. And when that's remembered, what is Dhamma and Vinaya should be taught. Yo Dhammo, yo Vinaya, so bhasitabbo. It means you understand if people are arguing, then you explain what's the reason, what's the basis behind the argument, why they're differing, why they come to this particular point. That's right, yeah. That's right. And then you remember where that problem was. If there was a problem, you remember what was wrongly remembered or wrongly put forth or wrongly argued, and you remember what was rightly put forth and rightly argued.
I mean, that's so making a judgment.
In a sense, that particular text so far, in a sense, this assumes that the person who's doing that would know how to make that kind of judgment. So the text itself is more concerned with how to settle the disputes, how to go about settling the disputes, rather than about how to actually make that assessment in the first place.
But also he says, went very fast, but he says, go to one person for this part
yeah.
of the thing, and go to the opposite side of the thing.
Yeah.
There might be different explanation, and how would you, like if you're the one asking the question, trying to figure out who's right and who's wrong.
No, in this case it's not assuming that you're trying to figure out who's right and who's wrong. It's assuming that there's a group of bhikkhus who are arguing about something and that you understand why they're arguing about it. So you go to one lot and you say, actually look, you've made a mistake here because you're relying on such and such a sutta to make your point, but actually this sutta was given in another context and it doesn't really mean that. Yeah? And then you go to the other one and you explain, well, this is a mistake that you're making here, and so you can remember that.
The point of this whole
passage
exposition is to show a process for settling a dispute. Basically.
Right, exactly.
So it's got nothing to do with working out the pros and cons of the situation, because it's assumed that the person that the Buddha's talking to would know.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are other places, as we've looked at other suttas, where the Buddha gives more details into how you actually figure out whether something works or not, or is true or not. Yeah? And again, sorry to interrupt, but that's another reason for thinking that this may be associated with the last days of the Buddha, because this was one of the great concerns at that time. Sorry.
Why does it refer to venerables and bhikkhus? Why is it all the same?
There's two words in Pali. The word translating as venerables is ayasma, and bhikkhu obviously is leaving untranslated as bhikkhu. Ayasma is from the root ayas, meaning life. So ayasma, literally venerable or aged one. But it's just a term of respect.
So is that referring to the person who you think is reasonable?
I think it would probably use them for both of them. Generally speaking, you use ayasma when a bhikkhu, you would use ayasma in speaking to any other bhikkhu, especially any senior bhikkhu. Bhikkhu itself isn't used as a title. Yeah, bhikkhu is a term. There's a monk who did this, but you don't refer to someone as bhikkhu so and so. Actually, it is used in that way sometimes, but normally not. Normally it's ayasma. Okay, so that's the case when they differ about both the meaning and the phrasing. The next case, you should think, oh, these venerable ones differ about the meaning, but they agree about the phrasing. Okay, and whoever you think is more reasonable should be approached and addressed. Thus, the venerable ones differ about the meaning but agree about the phrasing. They should know that it's for this reason that there's different about the meaning but agreement about the phrasing. Let them not fall into dispute. And similarly, approach someone on the other side. And explain in the same way. And what's wrongly grasped should be borne in mind as wrongly grasped. What's rightly grasped should be borne in mind as rightly grasped. Okay? There's a difference in the text here, I think. In Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, in the first case, he only mentions at the end what's wrongly grasped. Doesn't mention what's wrongly grasped and what's rightly grasped. In the second case, it says, bearing in mind what's wrongly grasped is wrongly grasped and what's rightly grasped is rightly grasped. So, but the Pali text, anyway, the one that I have in front of me here, has both wrong and right cases every time, which seems probably a little bit perhaps more sensible, but whether that's a variation in the manuscript or whether that's just a mistake in Bhikkhu Bodhi's edition, I'm not sure. Unlikely to be a mistake in Bhikkhu Bodhi's edition. It's more than 10 years old now, or nearly 20 years old, and I know he has corrected various mistakes like that. So that's right, yeah. So it may well be deliberate that it was all just wrongly grasped, yeah. So and you could understand if that was the case, and those kind of fine distinctions that you might find in the manuscript then might get erased later on. The copyists might just standardise everything. Yeah, so it's easy to understand how that would happen. Okay. Now, third case. So we've had ones where they disagree about the meaning and the phrasing. We've had the one where they disagree about the meaning and agree about the phrasing. And now, the third case, they agree about the meaning and they differ about the phrasing. Which any bhikkhu you should think is more reasonable should say venerable ones agree about the meaning and differ about the phrasing. The venerable ones should know for this reason that there is agreement about the meaning and difference about the phrasing, but the phrasing is a mere trifle. Let the venerable ones not fall into a dispute over a mere trifle.
That's like different
fonts. Oh, come on. We're talking about trifles here. He's laughing. He's perfectly serious. Okay. Now the Bhikkhu Bodhi's note here. This. Sorry. The statements made because slight deviations from the correct phrasing are not necessarily an obstacle to proper understanding the meaning. But elsewhere, the Buddha points out that the wrong expression of the letter and the wrong interpretation of the meaning are two factors responsible for the distortion and disappearance of the true Dhamma. So in other words, it's not that the phrasing is unimportant, but obviously less important than the meaning. Okay, I mean, obviously in some cases the phrasing is trivial, it doesn't make any difference. In some cases it makes quite a bit of difference. So that's right, yeah. Exactly, yeah. But there would be other cases where even a small difference in the phrasing would lead to a difference in the meaning. And that's another case, yeah. So, phrasing is a mere trifle.
In this case, in the Pali, what does it? Is phrasing, is that a literal translation from Pali?
Vyanjana. Vyanjana. Let me have a look at the. I've got a bug in my Chrome. Yeah, no, with the latest update, I've got a bug. It crashes whenever you enter a search field. So, there you go. Can't do it. I can, but then I don't fire it up enough. Anyway, Vyanjana means, basically that's what it means, is phrasing, as I said before. It's also used the same word for basically means to dress up, dressing or sauce or something like that. This is the Burmese spelling. It actually should be Vyanjana. Okay. Where are we? Okay, so, oh yes, the trifle. Appamattakam. Here's the word for trifle. It's appamattakam. Okay? Appamattakam. Just a little nothing. Now, in the next case, if you should think thus, these venerable ones agree about both the meaning and the phrasing, then whichever bhikkhu you think is the more reasonable should be approached and addressed thus. The venerable ones agree about both the meaning and the phrasing. Venerable ones should know it's for this reason, let the venerable ones not fall into dispute, and the bhikkhu on the other side should be approached. You both agree about the meaning and the phrasing. Sorry? Well, no, you can still have two groups, yeah, who maybe agree about something.
Maybe they don't know what they're agreeing.
Yeah, but there could still be two different groups. You might have the Dharma teachers on one side and the Vinaya teachers on the other side, or the people in this monastery on one side and the other monastery on the other side. They might not even know that they agree. They might just conventionally dismiss each other and say, oh, God, that mob over there, they don't know anything, you know, God. And then you say, well, actually, no, they're saying the same thing. Yeah? You can still have a dispute even though everyone's agreeing.
Taking the channels of communication.
Absolutely, yeah. Yep. Okay, so now I've got another bit of a gap here in the English. Now, it comes to another important section on discipline. While you are training in concord with mutual appreciation without dispute, some bhikkhu might commit an offence or a transgression. Okay, apati asya vitikamo. Now, because you should not hurry to reprove him. Okay? Taritabang. Should not hurry to reprove him. Rather, the person should be examined thus. I shall not be troubled, and the other person will not be hurt, for the other person is not given to anger and resentment. He is not firmly attached to his view, and he relinquishes easily, and I can make that person emerge from the unwholesome and establish him in the wholesome, if such occurs to you, because it's proper to speak. Okay? So just because somebody does something wrong, you don't immediately kind of lash out and criticize them or something, but first of all, you investigate what kind of person that they are, the pugala, and you reflect about whether they're somebody who can respond well if I admonish them in such and such a way, and if that's the case, then you can speak, then kalang vachanaya, it's appropriate to speech. Now it may occur to you, because I shall not be troubled, but the other person will be hurt, for the other person is given to anger and resentment. However, he's not firmly attached to his view and he relinquishes easily, and I can make that person emerge from the unwholesome and establish him in the wholesome. It's a mere trifle that the other person will be hurt, but it's a much greater thing that I can make that person emerge from the unwholesome and establish him in the wholesome, if such occurs to you, because it's proper to think. So this case is where somebody who maybe is a bit emotional, maybe is liable to get a bit angry or a bit upset if you admonish them or tell them off, but nevertheless they're quite reasonable, and maybe they go away afterwards and reflect about it, and then they correct themselves and so on. And so that's, you know, quite recognisable behaviour. I think we all see that in ourselves. And so in that case, then it's still worth admonishing them. And just to notice another language usage here, wuttapetwa, akusala wuttapetwa is the same word that's used, wuttana, in the bhikkhuni ordination. So it has the meaning of raising one. So here it says, from the akusala is wuttapetwa. So in the bhikkhuni ordination sense, it means raising one up out of one's former state into the new state of being a bhikkhuni. Sache pana bhikkhave evamasta. Then it may occur to you, because I shall be troubled, but the other person will not be hurt. So the other person is not given to anger or resentment, although he is firmly attached to his view and he relinquishes with difficulty. Yet I can make the person emerge from the unwholesome and establish him in the wholesome. It's a mere trifle that I shall be troubled, but it's a much greater thing that I can make that person emerge from the unwholesome and establish him in the wholesome, if such occurs to you, because it is proper to speak. So this is maybe somebody who maybe likes to argue, sort of likes their kind of ideas. You go and you want to talk to them, and they'll give you all the reasons why they're right and you're wrong and so on, and so it'll take you bloody ages to get anywhere. But at the end of the day, even though it might be a bit wearisome, then they can still kind of see some sense. Then yeah, it might be a long day, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Some people, I mean, even if it's not troublesome, some people are very, very reticent about
coming up and
criticizing somebody.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't think that I can imagine, somebody being very reticent to speak up, especially as a woman.
Yeah.
Not just because it'll be troublesome for them, in that it'll be a pain in the neck because they have to put up with this other person justifying themselves, but because they just generally, it's difficult to take money somewhere. I know lots of people.
And also, I mean, it can be quite a genuine thing. It's not necessarily just a hassle, but you might. You might suffer all kinds of disadvantages. Somebody might then go around and, complain about you, or they might attack back or something like that. So,
no, but in this case, the other person's not given to anger and resentment.
Right.
But in this case, it's so that the trouble is, it will bring this to the person who is doing the admonishing. It's the certain personalities that happen all the time.
Okay, next case. Next one. I shall be troubled, the other person will be hurt, for the other person is given to anger and resentment, and he is firmly attached to his view and relinquishes it with difficulty. Right, so everything's bad about it. Right? And yet, I can still make that person emerge from the unwholesome and establish him in the wholesome. It's a mere trifle that I shall be troubled and the other person hurt, but it's a much greater thing that I can make that person emerge from the unwholesome and establish him in the wholesome. If such occurs to you, because it is proper to think. Sorry, proper to speak. Proper to think. No, proper to speak. Then it may occur to you, because I shall be troubled and the other person will be hurt, for the other person is given to anger and resentment, and he is firmly attached to his view, and he relinquishes with difficulty, and I cannot make that person emerge from the unwholesome and establish him in the wholesome. One should not underrate equanimity towards that person. Okay? Eva rupe bhikkhave pugale upekha nati manitampa. Okay? So nice little phrasing there. Doesn't say to him, it doesn't say, you know, in that case, don't admonish them, right? You can still say something if you want to, but just don't underrate equanimity, yeah? Upekha. Sorry? Very true. Yeah. Absolutely. In some cases that's exactly the case. So you don't have to despair, because sometimes people just have to grow and they have to take their own time. Yeah.
But it doesn't say to
acknowledge
them either. In any of the other instances.
That's right. That's right. So that's
don't just be
well, it doesn't say don't. It just says, well, I wouldn't underestimate equanimity. Yeah. So it's certainly not prohibiting you from admonishing them if you want to.
Yeah, but if you put it in the context of everything else above, where it's giving you that example.
Sure. Yeah, it's certainly implying
they're
more.
Being very polite, it must say, don't admonish.
Right.
Being polite. I think also, it's one before, it's going to be a real passion between the two things, but
yeah.
Change your words.
Yeah.
In this case, it's also going to be a real passion for the two.
Yeah, yeah.
I suppose having enough wisdom to be able to tell where you'll succeed. I mean, if you're sort of allowing the individual to make the judgment that actually admonishing someone is going to cause a lot more harm than maybe not admonishing.
Can do,
yeah. Myself.
Can do, definitely, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so while you are thus training with mutual appreciation without disputing, there might arise mutual verbal friction. Vati sangharo. Or mutual or insolence in views. Dirti palaso.
What does
that mean?
Yes.
Dirti palaso. Insolence in view. It's not a particularly felicitous phrasing. It just means like a kind of rigid attachment to views. Yeah, stubbornness.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chetaso aghato, mental annoyance, bitterness, appachayo, and dejection, anabhi arabhi. Now then, whichever bhikkhu you think is the most reasonable of those who side together on the one part should be approached and addressed thus. Okay? And just to come back to that kind of most reasonable idea, the phrasing here is suvachatarang, where the tara is an ending meaning in the English and suvacha is in the Metta Sutta, yeah? Suvacho chasam madhu natimani, and in the English translation it says beautiful, what is that? Beautiful in speech or something? Gentle in speech. That's the Amawati translation, but it doesn't mean gentle in speech, it means, as in this case, easy to speak to. Yeah? So the most reasonable to speak to is Suvacha. Easy to speak to. Literally. Yeah. The best one to speak to. Okay, so whoever's
the. What does that actually mean? I mean, I'm sorry to say, you know, it's easy to speak to.
Yeah.
How do you take that mean?
Well, I think, you know, from this is somebody who, in a case of a dispute, you can talk to them and they'll be
reasonable.
Yeah.
And who'll actually speak back to you.
Yeah.
Who won't be offended if you talk to them.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think service is what's really some gracefulness about it.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's a positive.
Yeah.
Or very positive.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Okay. So he should say, then you say to him, well, while we're training, then this conflict arose. if the samana knew, if the recluse knew, meaning the Buddha, would he censure that? Tanjanamano samano garheya. Again, and I'm harking back to that use of samana Gautama in the origin. And it's slightly unusual, thing. The recluse samana is glossed by the Majjhima commentary with Satta, the teacher, referring to the Buddha. Similar usage of the term is found at Majjhima Nikaya 105, 18 and 21, which is the Sunakkhata Sutta. So, well, that's an occasional term used for the Buddha, but it seems slightly unusual. If the Buddha knew, would he censure that? Answering rightly, the bhikkhu would answer thus, if the Buddha knew, he would censure that. But friend, without abandoning that thing, can one realize Nibbana? And then the answer to that is, friend, without abandoning that thing, one cannot realize Nibbana. Apahaya etang avuso dhammang apahaya na nibbanang sacchikareyate. Then Nibbana cannot be realized. And notice the use of sacchi. Karoti is the same word that's used of the third noble truth in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. And then whatever bhikkhu you think is the most reasonable on the other side should also be approached and questioned similarly. The fathers should ask that bhikkhu thus, was it the Venerable One who made those bhikkhus emerge from the unwholesome and established them in the wholesome? Answering rightly, the bhikkhu would answer thus, here, friend, was it the Venerable One who made those bhikkhus emerge from the unwholesome and established them in the wholesome? Answering rightly, the bhikkhu would answer thus, here, friends, I went to the Blessed One. The Blessed One taught me the Dhamma. Having heard that Dhamma, I spoke to those bhikkhus. The bhikkhus heard the Dhamma and they emerged from the unwholesome and became established in the wholesome. Answering thus, the bhikkhu neither exalts himself nor disparages others. He answers in accordance with the Dhamma in such a way that nothing which provides a ground for censure can be legitimately deduced from his assertion. That's what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So again, notice the way that the Buddha's praising the form of phrasing, that one can phrase something in a way that doesn't exalt oneself or disparage others, but is accordance with Dhamma and can't be legitimately criticised. So the first phrase was it you who made these bhikkhus emerge from the unwholesome and establish them in the wholesome? So it's very self-centred, whereas this one is just based on the facts. It wasn't me who did those. I went to the Blessed One. The Buddha taught me Dhamma. Then I spoke to those bhikkhus. The bhikkhus heard the Dhamma, and then they emerged from the unwholesome and became established in the wholesome. So the emphasis comes back to the Dhamma rather than to the individuals. So this is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Okay, any more questions?
I wanted to ask about the early point you were making about the way the Buddha himself outlines his teachings.
Yep.
Do you think that that would have been something that when he first decided to teach, he also would have decided to lay it out in that way, in that complex kind of framework, or do you think that's something that would have developed over the course of the teachings as he was giving them over his lifetime?
I don't think he kind of planned it in a sense, but it's more, these teachings can be shown to come very naturally from the Buddha's first discourse, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, where of course he taught the Four Noble Truths, and say in that sutta then he mentions briefly the five aggregates, Sankhitena, in brief, the five aggregates are suffering, yeah? Then in second discourse he goes on to talk more about the five aggregates and why they're suffering. Yeah? And then that of course becomes the Khanda Samyutta. So I don't think it's a sense. I think he certainly had such a systematic and clear picture, vision of the Dhamma, that it was very natural that he presented things in a way that made so much sense and was so kind of formally perfect and memorable. And then sort of, you know, it's almost as if he sort of laid out the groundwork for a building with that first discourse, and then every other discourse he gave later, he sort of decorated it or improved it or showed some other detail. But the actual the whole framework of the Dhamma was right there from the first discourse. And let's finish up by paying respects.